You are listening to a discussion born in the Christian ghetto. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Christian Ghetto. I'm really excited today to have Ernst Van Zyl, otherwise known as Conscious Caracal on Twitter, who is the director of public relations for Afroform in South Africa and has been intimately involved in the parallel movements, parallel polity movements in South Africa. And just as these types of thoughts are getting off the ground here in North America, I thought it would be a real delight to have him on and to just talk about the practical realities of building parallel communities. What would be required? What are the conditions? What are the things you have to think about? All the kind of nuts and bolts stuff to take us from that theory cell into the practical realities. I also have a pleasure that I'm joined by one of, not regulars necessarily, but another Christian Ghetto member who is here, Black Horse, and welcome also, Black Horse. I'm looking forward to this discussion immensely.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity to share some ideas.
Yeah, so it's almost like I have so much stuff bouncing around in my head in terms of where to do. But how long has Afroform been up and running? You guys have been doing this for a while because it's like, what, 300,000 members now?
Yeah, so that's where the almost like reality pull comes in. I know a lot of people are desperate for quick fixes, almost like a fast food solutions to the problems we face. But I mean, the splash of ice cold water in your face that I have to give, otherwise I'm being dishonest, is that these types of projects take a long while. So Afroforum has existed since 2006, but it's not in 2006 that the organization or the idea is founded. Afroforum comes from the solidarity movement, which is much older. So the solidarity movement is at least more just over two decades old. And Afroforum was pretty much just one of the branches from that movement. So what you have to understand is when I describe some of the successes that we're achieving now in 2024 and in the past few years, this is something that takes time. It's not something you're going to be able to set up within a year. It's not something that you're going to be able to establish within just a few months. A lot of these real, sustainable, long-term solutions take time to establish as well. If you can accept that fact, then there's a lot of stuff, the whole world opens up to you. So, but if you're here for quick fixes and the fast food solutions, unfortunately, I'm not going to be telling you those comforting lies. I'd rather be confronting you with reality.
Yeah. So Ernst, I got a question here. So obviously today, Afroforum exists in the world of a very weak state and in the world of pretty aggressive explicit ethnic policy coming down from government, right? So there's a lot of outside pressure and at the same time, a lot of weakness in the state that kind of makes room for parallelism. If we look back to the early days of Afroform and the solidarity movement, was that always the case at the inception of the movement? Or how has that condition evolved and how has it affected the activities of Afroform?
So the simplest way to condense that decades-long story is that you don't get these types of movements or these types of initiatives out of a low-pressure environment. They necessarily come to the fore out of a high-pressure environment. So the best example would be for the type of caliber of neighborhood watches, the security solutions that you see. So in an environment where, for example, there's not pressure for communities to start organizing to make themselves safer, neighborhood watches are pretty much going to be people's hobby. It's a bunch of people that have firearms or are trained in community safety that want to use those skills, but they have a lot of free time, so they just want to kind of create this little ragtag team.
I understand that, but as a matter of history, is that Afroform formed in that environment and always was that organization? Is that correct?
Absolutely. I struggle to envision a scenario where these types of resilient organizations and real deal organizations come to the fore out of an environment characterized by comfort and low pressure and low aggression from the government side.
Well, it's interesting because before we went live, Kryptos and I were talking about kind of three very different contexts for parallelism. You've got the American context where you've got a very strong government, so there aren't a lot of patronage gaps. The government is still very good at providing basic services like roads. Canada's kind of in the middle where the government is much weaker than the US, but much stronger than South Africa. So there are more patronage gaps than in the US, but less than South Africa. The kind of pressure against parallel organizations is less as a consequence of that. But both environments are also characterized by kind of an order of magnitude less social pressure than has been exerted against Afrikaners in South Africa. So in South Africa, you have a very serious security problem that is kind of on everyone's radar. Whereas in the Canadian and American context, that security problem is much less. And so the kind of pressure you get is pressure at the level of, like, if you look at the concerns that animate parallelism in Canada, they're concerns about generational transmission of culture. They're not concerns about personal security. And so the focus here for parallelism has always been education, because like our government here is not especially good at, or doesn't provide the same kind of security gaps that the South African government does, but it's extremely effective at taking communities like ours and taking children and deracinating them and putting them into positions where they hate the values of their parents. Right, they hate the values of their people. And so the kinds of pressures are very different. And so it's kind of interesting to think through whether it's possible to animate people for parallelism with concerns that are not immediate. Because the concerns that animated Afroforum, there's like neighborhood watch, there's the fact that none of the infrastructure is being properly maintained. And kind of generational transmission of culture is actually kind of down the list of concerns that animated. Is that a fair assessment?
I think just a little bit of a disclaimer. It always frustrates some podcasts that host me that I'm not just here to tell you what you want to hear. I'm here to contribute to white pills, but not to counterfeit white pills. So I think a critical point to understand is that there's two states of being when it comes to when people get organized. There's the one state of being that we as Afrikaners kind of observe in the Western world, and that is where your external your existential fight is your hobby, and in South Africa your existential fight is a matter of survival, where it's the real deal. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you that at the moment you both still live in countries where your existential fight, from what I can see — I don't live there, I've never visited — but from what I can see, you are still operating as if your existential fight is your hobby. It's kind of something you care about, but you've also got other things that you're worrying about. And it's something you're passionate about, but it's not a matter of, I have to do this. And that's why I use the example of the neighborhood watches, where a neighborhood watch goes from just being people's hobby, of people in the community getting together because they've got nothing else to do and there's a little bit of a crime problem, to if we don't do something, this community is going to disintegrate and it's going to create a serious problem for everyone.
Well, it's a very different kind of pressure, because if the neighborhood watch doesn't function in an environment like South Africa, the community disintegrates imminently, right? But a month later, it's not there.
I was just going to say, like, maybe for those in the audience, the listening audience, who are not familiar with the South African context, to maybe, Ernst, just give people a brief background, sort of just sketch out from the beginning of where, because I know, because of coming from a Dutch ethnic background, right? The Boer Wars and all of these are told to us as part of, you know, our distant heritage, because that sort of folded in as sort of the broader, you know, ethnic Dutch community. But I know the Afrikaners think of themselves not really as Dutch, but as Afrikaner, and that your experience is uniquely tied to the southern tip of South Africa. So what is it that brought about as apartheid fell, what was it that brought the transition to the solidarity movement and how did it arise and what were some of the conditions? I mean, you mentioned neighborhood watches, but what were some of the things that led to it and sort of where did it go and how did you end up where you are today?
That's the critical question. And unfortunately, again, my answer is not going to be red meat for a lot of people in our sphere. They want to talk about
that's good, though. I think we need that because there's a lot of posturing and anyways, go on.
Sure. No. So, like I said, I'm going to give it to you straight. So, the environment where AfriForum and the solidarity movement comes from is an environment where you have a cultural group, the Afrikaners, that have been in control of the state apparatus for decades, and then in the blink of an eye lose control over that state apparatus. But not only is it your normal state apparatus, it's a modern state in the sense of every single responsibility has almost been delegated to the state. So that's from security to culture to education to language to infrastructure. Every single responsibility has been delegated to the state. There's actually been, if you look at the timeline, there was a much more community-based ethos among Afrikaners. And then when Afrikaners gain control over the state, they just give as much as of it over to the state as possible. Examples would be tertiary education institutions, where universities are started from a community level, from grassroots level. But as soon as you see, but now we're in control of the state, if we give this over to the state now, it gets a lot of more resources, a lot more power, and we can grow this even bigger. That temptation is almost irresistible to the Afrikaners at the time. So what happens then in 1994 is within the blink of an eye, a loss of control over a state, which pretty much you've delegated every single conceivable responsibility to over the past 4 or 5 decades. What is the result? Well, the result is your entire group is now has to reinvent the wheel from scratch in regards to how do we actually do cultural preservation? How do we actually ensure that our children are educated in our values and in not in a system that actively antagonizes them? And how do we operate within an environment where this state that we've built, this highly centralized state machine, is now just suddenly directed at us and used against us in a myriad of ways and increasingly so. And within that environment of losing control over the state that you've entrusted with your destiny over decades, within that environment, you get the solidarity movement and eventually AfriForum as well, which is in Afrikaans, we call it ons self, we'll do it ourselves, which is not a new path for Afrikaners, but it's more of a rediscovering of an old mentality of Afrikaners, where from a time where Afrikaners were not, for the majority of our history, in control over the state that's ruling over South Africa. You have to do everything yourself. There's the saying of, remember, you are on your own. If you don't do it, nobody's going to do it. So I want to make it clear that whatever we're doing is not revolutionary. It's not pioneering work. It's literally just going back in time and rediscovering a mentality that was, for the majority of Afrikaner history, the modus operandi.
And that's really, so what are the fundamental components then of doing it yourself? Like, because there is the community of Oranje, but the Afriform movement is bigger than just Oranje. There's other components that are going into it. So what are the kind of things that you began to put in place beginning in the 90s and then maybe more formally with the inception of Afriform?
So we have very good relations with Urania. We constantly work together in regards to a common goal that we're working towards, but Urania is not part officially of the solidarity movement. So the solidarity movement starts with the solidarity trade union that comes from that pretty much is the mine workers union of the 1990s that gets into an existential crisis of this organization is going to cease to exist on its current trend. And revolutionary thinking within the organization, thinking that if we restyle the organization to serve a cultural purpose rather than just a trade purpose, and tapping into not the socialist tradition of trade unions, but the Christian tradition of trade unions, we can actually make a serious difference. So from the solidarity movement, which starts as a labor movement, but not a labor movement in the leftist sense, but a labor movement in the Christian sense, you get the solidarity trade union, which then expands to the solidarity movement, which by 2024 now incorporates about 50 institutions. So it's rather than taking a centralized approach where you build an organization that does everything, that pretty much the shampoo that you can, or the body wash that you can use as a body wash, a shampoo and a toothpaste at the same time, you develop different products that specialize in specific aspects. So the solidarity movement today is a lot more sophisticated and complex than it was 20 years ago. But because of that approach of, we're not going to try to do everything, we're going to have this umbrella movement with different institutions under it, but every institution is going to have its focus, where it is, it's specialized. So Solidarity Trade Union is focused on labor disputes and labor-related issues. AfriForum is focused on community safety, community development, and community-based solutions. The Help and Hand, the Helping Hand, is specifically focused on welfare and community welfare. SALTEC, the technical college, is specifically focused on technical and trade education and training. Academia is a private university, which is specifically focused on the academic side in tertiary education, and then and so on. And then Marula Media is our private media house. So the whole movement grows out of this idea of specialization of, we're not going to try and do everything like a political party. We're going to actually try and party politics has failed the Afrikaner to a very strong extent. We're going to go in a different route, but not a new route where we have to, from the start, figure out everything. We just have to go find the answers in the past. So our, as a movement, our slogan is, let me just translate it. It's a renewal through proven values. So you go, it's the pretty much what Paul Kruger, the president of the ZAR, the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek, in the 1800s said, you take what is beautiful from the past, you identify and take what is beautiful from the past, and you build the future with it. So it's not a reactionary clinging to everything in the past is better than the present. You identify what is good and beautiful in the past, you take that and you build the future with it. And that's the philosophy of the solidarity movement as well.
Yeah. So there's a couple of interesting things here. So we began by talking about two key ingredients to the success of AfriForum: the outside pressure on the Afrikaners community, and the kind of weak state that left a patronage gap, which is being filled by a lot of these services that are provided by the various associations here. It seems to me that at this point, a very large proportion of the Afrikaans community is a member of these various associations. Is that an accurate assessment?
So yes, that's just for some perspective, and you can make your own draw your own conclusions from it. So AfriForum has 315,000 members. And to become a member, it's not like liking a Facebook page where you just fill in a form and now you're a member. You have to be a donating member to be counted as a member. So all 315,000 members of AfriForum are people that give a monthly donation. So that's 315,000. Out of, there's only 2.7 million Afrikaners. I think that was the 2011 census. If I have to guess based on trends, there's probably now about 3 million Afrikaners, but let's go on 3 million. So out of 3 million Afrikaners, about 300,000 are AfriForum members, but here's the critical detail. There are very few Afrikaner families where every member of the family is a member. So for example, me and my wife, I'm a member. The family that I come from, I'm blessed enough that both my parents are still alive. I'm a member and my father is a member, but my mother and my brother are not members. So that's the case where you don't really, it's not really practical for an entire family of four or five to each give a donation, because it's not just, like I said, liking a Facebook page. Yeah. You actually have to be a donating member. For practical reasons, I think it's safe to say that on average, every Afrikaner family, every Afrikaner that is a member of AfriForum pretty much represents one member of their family. So it's very, very few and far between where you'll find a husband, a wife, and their children are members. It's probably usually just the husband or just the wife or one, yeah, or one family member. So then if you take that into account, 300,000 members, you can pretty safely say that's about 300,000 families rather than 300,000 members.
Yeah, out of 3 million. So yeah, you're looking at maybe half of the African population is associated, yeah, in some way.
Yeah, that would be my educated guess, yes.
Now, you mentioned something interesting that you basically the Afrikaner community takes itself out of the normal political process. I assume, yeah, that
this is the other thing I was going to pick up.
You're all still involved in some way. I mean, you vote, there's parties. Cause I mean, I follow probably a dozen or more South African feeds, and there's regular commentary on the various different parties, most of it derogatory. But
we've got 48 to choose from.
For the most part, it seems like from what it sounds like you're saying is that what you've done is just said, well, politics is going to be politics. We're just going to go over here and do our thing, irregardless of what's happening. Well,
this is a key component. The Afrikaans community makes a self-assessment that they're not going to be able to control the state after the events of the 90s. It's uniquely obvious in the South African context that that's not going to happen. But this is a struggle you see for a lot of ethnic subcommunities in the West. The realization that the channels of official politics are inaccessible to them. Were there people within the Afrikaans communities who tried to find a place for themselves within the state after the revolution, or not?
So unfortunately, that story is a story of pretty much in the most ironic way, but I mean, it's not unique to history. The National Party government, the NATs, pretty much merged with the ANC to a large extent. Their representatives either retire into obscurity and exit politics, or they merge with either the Liberal Party or the leftist ANC. It's very strange how politics works. It creates very strange bedfellows. But I mean, whoever pays your wages or salary, I guess. So no, Afrikaners have been to a very large extent disillusioned with party politics, but that doesn't mean that Afrikaners as a whole have completely exited party politics. I think the majority of Afrikaners still vote in elections. They still vote for various parties. But what the Solidarity Movement represents is not a abandoning of party politics, but pretty much just moving party politics down a peg, moving it down the hierarchy of what is important. So for example, this year I'm still going to vote, but the finance bros always talk about diversifying your portfolio. Afrikaners have diversified their change portfolio. Where it comes to the paths towards change, you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. You're diversifying in regards to, if the election does not go my way, or the election does not go in a certain way that's favorable to me or my community, I've at least also got these other avenues towards change. And I think that's a critical point, because everyone just wants to think in black and white. It's like, okay, so you've completely written off party politics, so therefore you're just doing this new thing. I'm like, no, that's not the case. All that's happened is Afrikaners have been disillusioned to the point where they've started investing in multiple paths towards change. So for example, with the upcoming election in 2024, the common Afrikaner view of it would be that yes, elections definitely impact our reality and our lives, but there are other things that we can do that can make us election proof, where increasingly our community is resilient no matter what the results of the election may be. Now that's a long-term project, but that's what's happening, is a rather a multiplicity of means being employed rather than just writing off the main means and going to the next one. And just a final thought there, this ties into a phenomenon that I keep seeing on the online discourse as well, in our circle specifically, where you have to be pro one path or one solution. If you're not pro this solution, then you're off the right path. But that's not how politics or reality works. You can have a multiplicity of approaches towards gaining or getting to your goal in the end. It's not about you are either pro or anti, or you are this or that, you're this label or this label. That's not how reality works. People have a multiplicity of approaches that they are following towards the same goal. And I think it's very detrimental that we have, it's almost like people arguing between Pepsi and Coke when it comes to solutions as well. They're like, but this is my solution that I've built my entire identity around. This is the only way. And because you're not endorsing this solution as your main solution, therefore you're completely off the beaten track. That's a very counterproductive way of looking at it. You rather should be looking at it of what are the different paths that we are following to the same place, and we can use those paths in tandem to get to the same place, and they complement each other.
I mean, this is certainly, there's certainly some wisdom to that. Let me put forward a counter case here. Mm-hmm. So if I look at the history of the Christian subcommunities in Canada, parallelism here really began when the realization began to dawn on the community that we no longer had the ability to exert influence on the national government, right? So as long there was an, we went from a position in really in the really ending sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, where we lost control of the central government to a group of people who are extremely hostile to our communities, extremely hostile. But it took a long time for it to dawn. Like, these are people who, you know, call the burning of churches understandable, that kind of thing. And it took a long time for that realization to dawn on our community. And as that realization has dawned on our community, people have suddenly decided that they've decided to reallocate resources. They've decided to reallocate their time, their attention, their money. And as long as you could make a credible argument that they were going to have a voice in national politics, they were unwilling to do that because it's expensive, it's time consuming to build communities of your own that are not financed out of what is still a relatively rich state. So it's, in a lot of ways, it's been a huge blessing to our community to be formally excluded from national politics, to have formally hostile legislation passed, because it's taken away that kind of alternate outlet that used to consume a lot of time, money, and various other kinds of resources from the community. And in a way, if you look at solidarity, if the Afrikaans people still had a pathway available to them to have an Afrikaans mm-hmm. president tomorrow morning, you might see a lot of the time and hopefully you wouldn't, but you could imagine a world in which a lot of the time and money currently focused on community solutions might be redirected unproductively. You understand the point?
Absolutely. I think that's a very legit point when it comes to where people's focus is and where they direct their resources to. But I think this is where the nuance comes in, where what we really need to do is people just need to realize how little effort an election takes and then...
Yeah.
So you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can dedicate 364 days of the year to alternative parallel solutions, and then every 5 years, just for one day, you go stand in line and vote for a party that frustrates the system.
Yeah.
That can't hurt. If you don't do it, you're not a traitor, you're not failing your community, you're not a horrible person, or you're not ineffective. But at the same time, that's my advice, is dedicate within 5 years, every year, dedicate 365 days to parallel institutions and to building alternative solutions. And then for one day every 5 years, you go vote and vote for a party that helps you create more space for that main goal. And that's the best way to handle it.
Yeah, but you're not getting up every day, giving your money to the party, dedicating your time and energy to community organizing.
No.
Because
your sacrifice is 30 minutes to go stand in a line and make a little cross next to a picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
so you can do both.
The curious thing for me too, like, one of the, again, the differences in the South African context is, of course, the ethnic homogeneity. There's a strong religious and faith homogeneity. And also, I assume, although this is just maybe my assumption, a geographic proximity to each other. Like if I understand it correctly, the Afrikaner are not spread out all over South Africa. They're located in a fairly proximate location to each other. So they're, correct me if I'm wrong, but relatively close to each other, have a strong ethnic unity and a high degree of you know, shared belief system in that regard.
So on the first point, you're absolutely correct. So it very much helps if your community is 95% Calvinist rather than divided along religious lines. That helps a great deal. And then secondly, the reality of Afrikaners is actually demographic dispersal. So you've got a lot of concentrations in specific places. So for example, Pretoria, the city where I stay, is a very high concentration of Afrikaners. I think the last time I looked at the statistics, 500,000 out of 3 million Afrikaners live in the city of Pretoria. So that's a high concentration. But a lot of Afrikaners are spread out across the different small towns. Because remember, it'll make sense if you think about the term boer. So Afrikaner and boer are the two synonyms for the Afrikaners. But boer means farmer. And farmer means you, wherever there's farming, the Afrikaners are there. So despite concentration points existing, so a concentration point like Pretoria, a concentration points like, for example, some of the bigger towns in the countryside, the rest of the Afrikaners are pretty spread out. And that's actually where the solidarity movement's whole strategy of demographic concentration comes in, where we are actively encouraging Afrikaners to live more concentrated rather than dispersed, because where you live in a concentrated manner, you can actually start influencing reality. That's the whole philosophy around Urania being built in a literal demographic wasteland, or as they call it, a demographic desert. They went and looked at the South African map and they're like, where does nobody want to live and where does nobody live? Like, oh, here in the middle of the Karoo Desert, where the soil quality is on par with Mars and the weather is not far away from the weather of Mars. Let's go live there. And that people that are ignorant always tell them, why do you live in this shitty desert? And like, that's the point. That's the whole point. You're living where nobody wants to live, where nobody is going to follow you. You're just living there and you're living on land that nobody has historically owned and land that nobody wants. So it's not, there's no drawing factors there. So that
sounds very Calvinist.
To a large extent, yes, you go to where there's as little resources as possible and then you build something purely just out of your pure labor.
The sheer stubbornness of being Dutch Calvinist distraction. Yeah,
but I call the Uranias the desert Afrikaners. So they're a specific type of Afrikaner. There's many different Afrikaners in South Africa, but the Iranians are desert Afrikaners. So they're the guys that can flourish on the surface of Mars. And I've made this point as well, where I also come from a line of desert Afrikaners. So my ancestors lived in the Karoo Desert in the Beaufort West area. And if you go look on Google Maps, if you ever want to get some perspective on the land debate in South Africa, just Google what the satellite view of the Karoo Desert or the Northern Cape looks like.
Yes.
You will be unable to distinguish between what you're seeing there and the surface of an uninhabitable planet. And that's where my ancestors live. They lived there for multiple generations and they turned a place where humans can't live without borehole technology into a place that's viable for agriculture. And that's exactly what the Iranians did as well. But to finalize that point, that's why I always keep telling people there's freedom in the desert, both metaphorically and literally. You have to go where people don't want to go. You shouldn't be congregating where the prosperity is. You shouldn't be congregating where there's comfort. You shouldn't be congregating where it's easygoing. You should be going where human nature doesn't want you to go. That's the only way where you're not going to be swamped by people that just want to live where it's comfortable.
Well, it's interesting in a sense of almost because, like, my ancestors were loyalists. They were driven here after the American Revolution. And at the time, it was land that nobody wanted.
Exactly.
The British Crown bought it for a penny, and they made a little England here. And because they made a little England here, you know, they carved beautiful farmland out of land that nobody thought could ever be farmland.
They willed it into existence.
And now it's the largest city in Canada, and every migrant who comes to Canada plops right on top of where, you know, my great-great-grandfather's church is now a giant apartment building filled with migrants.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the point, is that this is always going, I mean, you're never going to be able to escape human nature. You're never going to be able to escape these demographic push and pulls. But yeah. In your time where you have a choice, where you have to choose between X, Y, and Z, you have to choose to go where the frontier is. You have to choose to go where everyone else is going, not wanting to go. You should be going where people don't have an incentive or a desire to go. That's the only place where you're going to find freedom. In your ancestors' time, that was on the Canadian frontier and on the US frontier, if you go a bit farther back. In my ancestors' time, that was the northern frontier, but into the northern the Kalahari Desert specifically.
But what that's going to be going forward is a whole other discussion.
But absolutely.
There is something to that, though, Ernst, that this idea that by seeking, like, wherever you find the frontier, whether it's within the empire or at the edges of the empire or, you know, the land, is that you are in some ways bringing a struggle onto yourself to forge yourself together as a people. So you're in a sense of saying we're going to embrace a struggle to shape ourselves and become a people in and through this struggle. And so separate ourselves out as a result from the broader population.
Absolutely. But I mean, here's the central point, and here's where the Uranians get it right. They are the first group of Afrikaners in our history to recognize the perils of exploiting cheap labor.
Yes.
That's the root of modern South Africa. The modern South Africa, the economic zone called South Africa, is built on the idea of cheap exploitable labor. And the Uranians are the first group of people in this country's existence that said, we are going to make exploitation of cheap labor illegal. We are going to use only labor within our community. So that means, and this is what's radical, it breaks people's brains, even Westerners' brains. It's like, it's not even that they are only going to use Afrikaner labor. They are only going to use labor within their community. So you can't even import cheap Afrikaner labor from Pretoria, a bunch of homeless Afrikaners, and say, here's some jobs for you. The whole point is we are going to use the labor and the resources within our own community, and that's in the long run going to set us free. I mean, that's what the point that Flip Bayse in his book, the Patna Self-Bestuur, the path to self-governance, makes. He says, you have to remember, every person that you import to your community as cheap labor brings with him the demand that in the future he is going to want a say in your politics. And that's not necessarily wrong, but you created this environment now. So you can't then, if you import thousands of people for cheap labor into your community and somewhere down the line they say, well, we want to say in this community that we help build, you don't really, and this is, again, not red meat for your audience, but you don't really have an answer to that. You're going to have to be disingenuous and say,
The answer is ultimately yes.
The answer is yes. You help, when they claim they help build this community, you can't tell them without being disingenuous, no, you had no part in it. You literally imported them to help build your community. And that's where the Iranians are like, from day one, we are going to make sure that every single brick in this town was laid by an Iranian, so that no person today, tomorrow, or in 1,000 years can say that you exploited our labor to build this. Therefore, we want a slice of your politics.
That's something that in different ways, like one of the key political transitions for myself, because I grew up as sort of a bog standard, you know, global free trade, quote unquote, conservative. And one of my realizations was that all of the people from the labor union who were critical of this idea of global free trade, because that they were all right. And, you know, the whole notion of labor arbitrage, you know, import the jobs overseas, bring cheap labor into it when you can't ship something overseas, just to basically, you know, cut wages to third world levels. You know, people always say, well, we can't get our people to do this kind of work. And I said, well, yeah, no, you can't get them to do this kind of work at third, you know, for third world wages. Sure. And I've said to people, well, you know, you can, there's a lot of things that you could do to make society better. And to create near full employment and so forth and so forth. But it would it means that you as a professional would have to take a 25% cut in your standard of living, because you would have to pay the people down the street to make it for a price that is much higher than if it's shipped off to Asia, or you bring in immigrant labor to do it here. And once you bring it into that level, a lot of people aren't willing to make the lifestyle sacrifices to say, hey, no, we're going to build it and make it ourselves, even though it costs more and it lowers our overall standard of living. It's just a better existential way to live life. So I guess that was it, sort of leads to the next question, is to what degree is a community like Orania self-sufficient? And I guess that's part of the goal with the Afrikaner community, is to become almost as self-sufficient as possible. Because that, you know, there's all these nuts and bolts stuff of like building roads, providing power, and you know, currency, and all of these other layers of stuff that make it very hard to fully disentangle yourself from the broader body politic.
So here's the critical point when it comes to self-determination and self-sufficiency, is that a lot of people put the cart before the horse. They want the borders and they want the piece of land, and then they'll build their self-sufficient community or country there. That's not how it works. You build your self-sufficient community and then you hoist your flag. But that's the difficult part. Everyone wants the easy road of like, give me my piece of land. In the Afrikaner history, you'd say, give me my Volksstaat, my ethno state, or whatever you want to call it, and then I'll build my country there. That's not how it works. That's you have to build your own reality. And that's exactly, Orania is actually such a good example. And I mean, I'm taking a lot of liberties, seeing as I don't live in Orania, but I know the community very intimately. I've visited more times than I can count, and I think I know the majority of the town by this point. But they proved a very important point, and that was when they went to not them specifically, but Afrikaner representatives went to meet with former President Thabo Mbeki decades ago in the early 2000s or the late 1990s. I'm not exactly sure where it happened. But in this meeting, they're talking to President Thabo Mbeki, who's from the ANC. The ANC is already in power. And they ask him, do you support a place where Afrikaners can call their own and have self-determination? He says, yes, but that place doesn't exist. And in his words, show me the animal. Show me the place where you want self-determination. And it completely just floored the Afrikaners, because they couldn't point to a single place where they said, here, what he basically meant is, where are you a demographic majority and where have you created the reality of here you can have self-determination? And they couldn't point to anywhere. So the option existed, like, yes, I'll give you your self-determination. Where do you want it? And nobody can point to anywhere. So it's a wasted opportunity. And the lesson there is, Until you have a place where, when you are confronted and asked, where do you want your freedom? And you can't point and say, here we want our freedom, and here's why, because we've created the conditions for it here. We have a demographic majority here. We can handle every single thing from water to electricity here. You're not going to get it. And that's why my colleague Adam Roots always talks about freedom is not demanded, it is built. So you can't demand your way to freedom in any way. That's where a lot of even Afrikaners today still make the mistake, where they're like, well, the South African Constitution guarantees under Section 235 self-determination for any people in South Africa. I'm like, yes, But when you go through that process, you're going to have to say, where do you want your self-determination? You can't just say, I want a slice of the country. You're going to say, here is where my people are concentrated, and here we have the means for self-determination. Until you have that to show, you don't have an answer to that question. You don't have any chips on the table, and you've got no leverage. So that's a hard fact that a lot of people just refuse, unfortunately, to accept, is you can't just demand freedom. You build it, and then you force the system to acknowledge it. That's the other thing about where Urania is a great example. Again, they didn't ask the government, give us a patch of land and we'll build something there. They built something, and then they told the government, well, this reality is on the ground, whether you like it or not. You can accept it and make it official, or we can clash about it. And the government was just like, well, no, you seem to be able to handle all these services and all these other things that you've already proven you can do. You can have this piece of land. So, and I mean, that's personified in the court case that they won. So in the late 1990s, there was a court case to incorporate a bunch of, so every piece of South Africa had to be incorporated under a municipality. And Urania was then going to be incorporated under the I can't remember what the name was, but the municipality that controls Hopetown and the whole area. And then that would have meant that they can't do their own municipal services. The municipality is going to have to do that. And then they went to court, and they argued in court, here is how we already, for the past 10 years, more than a decade, we've been doing everything that a municipality does. And then the court ruled, well, you've created the reality on the ground. We can see no reason why the municipality now needs to take over these responsibilities. You can have those responsibilities. But if they had not created that that reality prior to that court challenge, they would have had no leg to stand on. So it's, again, it's that principle of you're going to have to do the work first, and then you get recognition and acknowledgement. But you force the state into a position where they have to acknowledge your reality. It's so unignorable.
I mean, this is interesting. So
But as you're talking about it, it's almost kind of mind-blowing in a sense of really.
Well, go ahead, Michael. Yes and no. This is exactly what the French Canadians did when they gradually forced the English out of Quebec and then prepared to hold referendums to separate. The struggle that they have is that you mentioned Orania is very intentionally built in a desert so that people won't come. Quebec has its own set of defense mechanisms to try to protect its ethnic integrity. They kind of hide it under language, but the premise is to keep their people in control of their land so that at any moment they can threaten to separate from Canada. This is the issue. When you go and build realities like this, there has to be a clear friend-enemy distinction. There has to be a clear mechanism by which they're protected from the force of deracination, right? Mm-hmm. The force of people who are not loyal to that community coming, and the force of people who generationally who were the generations to follow those who built that community ceasing to be loyal to it and dispersing.
That's why you can't build a community based on ideology. It's the strangest thing. I constantly get confronted with it from American and European thinkers, like, we're going to go create our own space based on our ideology, and everyone that agrees with our ideology can come in. I'm like, well, that's doomed to fail.
That's right, because you can't controlling the you've got to be able to control it at both levels. You have to be able to control it generationally within your community, and you have to be able to control it in terms of, and you have to be able to prevent it from being flooded with people from the outside.
Well, it's interesting because, like, ours here in the Canadian context, and even to some extent in the American context with the Dutch Reform community, has experienced some of that. It is interesting, like, you go to places like even Iowa, where they have been since the 1850s, and Western Michigan, they're still a self-identified Dutch Reform community. Now, they think of themselves as Americans, and many in the Dutch Reform community in Canada think of themselves as Canadians, but there's still very clear lines. But what you're saying is very important there, Ernst, that up until even very recently, and even still today, you can go into a Reformed church and find people who vote for all of the major political parties, right? Mm. And but it's built around the institutions of largely church, school, and a couple of others, like, you know, the Christian Labor Absolutely. Association of Canada and a few other small organizations, but largely church and school.
Yes.
And when you're in a school together, nobody ever agrees all the time on how things should be done, you know? And so to say that, yeah, we're going to build a community on ideology is just silly, other than the fact of, like, yeah, we definitely do not want to entrust our children to the state to educate them, and partly because it's important to maintain a community, but we also believe that as a Christian vision, it's important to educate our children separately in our own value and belief system. And that larger overwhelming purpose, that larger sense of identity, is what enables you to carry through on the differences of, okay, we all have this shared sense of we want to build something together, and how do we build it? And then the disagreements that ensue on the best way to do that are overcome in large part because there's a larger identity under which you are subsumed, which is, in my case, it's ethnicity and faith. And I think that's a very similar system or reality for the Afrikaner community. There's ethnicity and there's faith. And a lot of those realities allow you to move past many of the disagreements of, okay, how do we actually get from here to there? And when you actually will end up running into real differences and how to do it on the ground.
Yeah. And there's a simple question that I'm convinced if your movement or your group or your whatever you are trying to build does not have an answer to this question, you're wasting your time. And that's the very simple question of who are we? You can't answer that question, you are wasting your time with everything else that you're doing. You can't, and you don't need an academic answer. It doesn't have to be a PhD thesis on this is who we are. Every person in your community or whatever you are trying to build has to be able to answer that question, even if it's in their own simple language. They have to be speaking from their heart. They can't just give you a memorized, this is what I read in a textbook. This is what an Afrikaner is. Like, no, if someone asks you, who are the Afrikaners? Who are you? You need to be able to answer that question. If you can't answer that question, like I said, everything else you're doing is just live action role play. It's not real because you're not building it on a solid foundation.
And not only that, it has to be a question that every, like, up and down your community can be answered. It can be answered by the leadership class of your community, but it also needs to be able to be answered by, you know, the kids, the lowest IQ member.
More than it's put into words.
Yeah,
absolutely. But that's why I said it doesn't have to be a standard definition that everyone recites. It's something where you just need an answer that's solid to that question, where you don't even have to say, well, I'll get back to you. That's the point.
No.
And you don't even necessarily have to like everybody in your community either. No. Like that's part of the thing. Well, it's like there's a lot of
I almost want to say that's going to be the default position. You're not going to like people in your community. That's kind of just the default.
Well, and this is one of the things that drives me nuts and especially in online discourse where people talk, well, you have to really curate your groups to make sure that they're all aligned perfectly. And I'm like, dude, you have no idea what a community is like, because
that's not a human community.
That is not a human community. Like, no, you have to be together first with people that you may or may not like, who have a shared purpose, and everybody kind of understands that. And one of the things is setting aside your personal feelings and disagreements to get stuff done that you all share as part of a larger agreement or a larger community that we're in.
Absolutely. And like I said, it comes down to that point of, if we can't even agree on what is the basic building blocks of who we are that we are using to build this initiative or whatever we are trying to build, then the whatever you're trying to build is going to fail before it even takes off. That is the basic answer, or the basic question that demands an answer for anything that you're going to build, is that answer to who are we. But as I said, just as important is that you don't become bureaucratic in the sense of you all have to memorize this definition from this textbook. It's almost in that cliche sense of the Spartans, where the answer to who are we is written on the hearts of every member of your community. It just naturally is there.
If you need to develop, if you need to have a committee to develop a mission statement, you're probably already in a bad spot to begin with.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's, in terms of the North American context, and maybe even to some degree the European context, but definitely the North American context, this really is the big snag. And this is really the crime in some ways that has been committed against and for largely commercial purposes. This idea that, well, you know, if your community is failing, we are told, well, you just need to move and go where the jobs are, that your community is secondary to the economic prosperity of the nation. Right. And in many ways, that really is backwards, is that the communities really should have been put ahead of the economic prosperity of the nation. And it's not that it's not unimportant, like people need to be able to eat and have food and clothes and so forth.
But
this idea that you would destroy communities just for jobs is mind blowing to me.
But the issue is, at that time, people believed that they owned the whole nation. Right. So moving from Detroit to Ohio didn't mean leaving your community. It was all your community as Americans.
But was it though? That's, I guess, the question.
But this is the issue, right? So in Canada, we're now 20, 25 years into knowing at a bone level, maybe 35 years into knowing at a bone level that the country isn't our community. Our community is this smaller thing, right?
Yes.
And this is a fundamentally, like, the Afrikaners had a very definite moment where they realized the state didn't belong to them. It was a more gradual moment for Canadians. But there are a lot of people in the Western world for whom this moment has not yet occurred, right?
Especially in the US.
Yes. And if that moment has not yet occurred, you haven't begun the process of forming a community which is capable of parallelism.
That's why we talk about state-proofing your community. You have to get to a point where as much of your responsibilities you can take up without delegating them to the state. That's why I said the big damage done to Afrikaners specifically by becoming statists is that we delegated everything to the state until the point where we overnight just lost all of that, and then we had to reinvent the wheel from scratch. And I mean, that's what you're seeing now in South Africa, where now the ANC is in charge of the state, and now their people are delegating every single responsibility to the state, creating a massive welfare state, basically, where 50% of all South Africans are dependent on some form of government grant. And I just keep thinking, the day that this collapses, you are going to have to reinvent the wheel again from scratch.
Well, especially because the collapse of the South African state is, you know, it's telegraphed to anyone paying attention.
But that's the thing, is where you should never be praying or working towards collapse. I think accelerationists are people that are working towards making people's lives worse. You need to be building your life raft. You should not be trying to break down the Titanic so it sinks faster. You should be buying yourself time and also building your life raft as fast as possible, not trying to say, well, if the ship sinks faster, more people will help me with my life raft. I'm like, no, that's psychotic logic. Then don't do that.
Yeah. And in this sense, we're not revolutionaries. There's not the sense that if we burn it all down, then the glorious future will emerge.
No.
You know, like this idea that billions must die is appalling. And I think one of the things that separates us from being actually leftist is to say that, no, you really don't want billions to die and millions upon millions of people to suffer just to change the regime. So the alternative then is to begin building something. But like you're saying, Ernst, like one of the struggles that you have is getting people to think about stuff like, why do you trust the state to educate your children? You know, just little things like this, we have to fight for the public schools. And you're like, okay, that's good. But you're fighting a losing battle. You still have not disentangled your own identity enough from the state to actually become a people that can resist.
Why can't you defend yourself? Why have you delegated the responsibility of keeping your community safe? Why have you given the state a monopoly on that?
Yeah. like
that's policing. The type of questions people need to start asking. It's tough. I mean, that's human. You're fighting against human nature. Human nature is delegating responsibilities to other more centralized organizations.
You're not just fighting against human nature. You're fighting against So the actual answer to that question in many contexts is because if I attempt to defend my own community, the government will come and put me in jail, right? Mm. The reason why, so why is it that the sub-communities that would like to separate in Canada don't have their own neighborhood watches? The answer to that question is that anyone who participates will be arrested immediately, right? And in some ways,
short order anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. Like very, very, very quickly. And they'll go to prison basically forever because it's the only thing the Canadian government cares about is arresting people who try to defend themselves.
And the interesting thing is the people that have, and this is similar in the US as well, the people that have the most sense of community identity are rural communities that have no need for policing because they're relatively safe. I mean,
well, yeah.
My goodness, I know people that leave at their farms quite literally leave the keys in the truck in the farms. Like they don't even take their keys into the house. Like,
well, my in-laws didn't lock. They only lock the house when they leave for like a month. Like, it's just like, it's just, not a
looking
concern.
Here to my right to my window here, and I've got prison style bars on it as thick as almost a baseball bat.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a very, very different context, and so we're not quite there yet. But there are urban places in Canada where these types of things are happening.
Where I grew up, it's now like the government advises you to leave your car keys by the door, so that when people break into your house to steal your car, then they don't come and attack your family. Like it's a very different. Things have changed a lot, and that's a neighborhood I didn't lock my doors in growing up.
But I mean, I can't really speak for the American or the Canadian context because I don't live in a state that is governed by one of the strongest governments in the world. But
that's right.
There is something, and maybe, like I said, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm getting arrogant in that sense, but I always use the metaphor of the Kruger National Park, on our largest nature reserve, that's filled with lions, but it's also filled with porcupines. So a porcupine is a very small animal. It's the size of like a cat, basically. But lions don't hunt porcupines. Now and again, they eat one. But over the long run, there's still thousands of porcupines in the Kruger National Park, even though there are lions walking around as well. That's 220 times its size and has a lot of muscle and teeth that can pretty much kill it in a second. But that's because the porcupine has developed spikes on its back that can ensure that I'm not worth eating. If you try to eat me, you're going to either be blinded or you're going to get a deadly infection. So don't even try it. And that's why there's still porcupines walking among lions in the Kruger National Park. And I feel, like I said, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel that's how communities need to start operating, specifically if you have a very powerful state. It's just make yourself inedible. Get to the point where it's not worth it. Don't try it. I mean, it's a very controversial example, but I mean, look at even something like Waco, where there's just 80 people that are armed within a compound. I mean, you pretty much brought the US government to a state of fucking panic. Yeah. Just because you are concentrated in one point and you're armed and you're saying, it's not worth it. You're pretty much looking them in the eye and saying, it's not worth it. Don't do it. Now imagine if you have a community like Urania, that's 3,000 people. They're all armed. They all are very passionate about what they're building and what they're working towards. It's practically impossible for a powerful state to take that on. It's the lion trying to eat a porcupine and getting a face full of quills that could, in theory, kill it if it gets infection, or very likely blind it because it's going to poke two of its eyes out. There's this old joke of the guy at the bar that says once there were 10 guys tried to jump this guy at the bar and said, you looked at one of our girlfriends funny, we're going to kill you. And he says, fine, you can try to kill me, but one of you is going to lose your eyes. And then they left him alone. because nobody was willing to take that risk of I'm going to be one out of 10 chance that this guy is going to stab my eyes out with his fork or with his knife, but he's going to die. But that was his strategy and he survived. It's a bit of an exaggeration. It's a bit of a joke that's often told here in South Africa, but it's the same principle.
Yeah, I mean, we're very much at an inflection point with this in the post-COVID world in Canada, where there's no better way to say this than a lot of our people gave the government a big black eye during COVID because they were forced to do a lot of very uncomfortable things to us in order to, you know, they were forced to put our pastors in prison. They were forced to declare martial law. They were forced to walk through all of this charade in order to crush it. And it was very uncomfortable for them. And the question is what happens next? And it's a very, very interesting question. One that our community is going to have to answer.
But here's a question I have for you, Ernst. Like the notion of Orania in terms of its building, like, because they came from other Afrikaner communities, correct? And was there like a small group that began it, or did they just kind of put a call out in the Afrikaner community, say, hey, listen, let's do this thing? Was it a kind of an intentional thing? Hey, we're going to build it to 3,000 people, or did they start with like, you know, 10 families and it just kind of grew? Because I could see here, like in the Canadian context, if you had, say, two or three communities of that size, that given the weakness of the, like, say, the Canadian military, they probably, if they were forced to de facto, right? Yeah, they couldn't oust you here because they just don't have the strength. Canada parts and relies on its citizens not doing this. Just trust that you're not good. But I could see if you had two or three communities of like 2,000 or 3,000 that just said like, well, screw you. We're just going to build our own community, supply our own power, our own policing and so forth. We're going to feed ourselves and you guys can just go bugger off, that you might actually be able to make it happen. So I'm kind of curious how they began that process to say, hey, let's build a community in the middle of the desert.
So, yeah, I'll give you the contact details of one of my friends that's the head of the Orania movement, U.S. Strydom. He'll be able to give you the detailed history. But it started off as, about a dozen families that got together in this ghost town. And that's why it grew so slowly, is it started off by, we're not going to tell all the Afrikaners, come live here. You're welcome to come live here if you want, but you're going to have to work and help build. But it grew slowly because only the people that had the right idea, that were admitted that we are willing to give up all the luxuries and comforts of city life or South Africa as a whole and come live in this community and build towards an ideal. And that's why it's growing so slowly. But it's a blessing in disguise, because if suddenly 10,000 people show up in your community, that's going to completely crack your infrastructure. It's not possible. You can't accommodate those people.
Exactly.
You're going to be creating a slum. So what you need is a slow buildup of, as the population grows, you grow capacity. I know the town is growing, according to their latest census, at about 12% population per year. That's a good growing rate. That means that they can update their infrastructure and have it keep up with the population growth. And this is very important, if your town is built on a philosophy, on an idea, or for example, let's take Orania, the idea of own labor. If you have a town here, demographics again, our destiny, if you have a town of 3,000 people that understand that idea, and you flood it with 10,000 people, same culture, same religion, everything, but they don't buy into that idea of own labor, you destroy that community, because now 10,000 people outnumber the 3,000 people that understand what it's about, and then it's gone. So you don't want that massive
influx. Yeah, no tourists.
No. So when it comes to not just Orania, but the principle at the heart of it, is that you'd rather want people slowly buying in and slowly growing sustainably, and only the people that really understand what it's about coming there, or people that will within a year or two understand what it's about, rather than having a massive influx of people and them immediately outnumbering the people that understand what it's about, and then the town just becomes like every other town in the world, where your philosophy that drives you is market speed and production, where, well, we understand your whole idea of own labor, but we really need this thing, so we're just going to bend the rules very quickly for this one time. We're going to import some labor from the outside just to build this one thing, and then we're going to get back to our agenda. Break the rule once, you're never going to go back. That's the lesson from Urania, and that's why they are so stubborn about it. They're like, no, under no circumstances do we tread over that line. We only use labor within the town, within the community.
That is such that is something that I'd never really given a thought to in this whole, and that I, you know, if I've taken away one thing from it, is this idea that, and it's almost like the Mennonite communities, like we build our own barns, we build our own houses, we maintain our own, you know, and you need to start now because you have to play the long, slow game. There's no way to do something like this quickly.
That's funny, because that's the point. That's the comment that we started this entire conversation on, when I said, I'm not here to give you a fast food solution. This is something that takes time, but the best day to start is yesterday, and the second best day to start is today. But that's the thing. One of my friends sums it up perfectly when it comes to this whole principle of building it yourself. There's a lot of towns, or not a lot, there are some places in South Africa that try to emulate what Urania has done, but they don't emulate it for one simple reason. So Urania from the start has been dedicated to their principles and to their vision of, we are only going to use our own labor and our resources within our town. An example of another town, I can't remember what the name was, but there was another town that tried to emulate what Urania does. And an Uranian representative went to visit to see what's going on there. And he got there and he saw just people of all communities, all cultures, they're building these houses, a lot of black cheap labor, to put it very directly. And he asked the town manager there, you're trying to emulate Urania, but you're exploiting cheap black labor. What's going on? He's like, no, don't worry. We're just going to use it to build the first 100 houses here so people can come live here. And then we're going to institute the own labor policy. And then he asked him the question, but you know, when you start using your own labor cost goes up immensely. So how are you going to convince the 101 number house, the person that's building the 101 number house, that he's going to have to pay three times the amount of the first 100 houses that were built with cheap labor? There, at that point, your community collapses. And the person didn't have an answer. And that's where the key point is. You have to firstly answer the question, who are we? And secondly, what is the philosophy or the idea that we're building this community on? What's the central principles that we're building it on? And we're not diverting from it. We're not making exceptions. Because as that story proves, once you make the exception, there's no going back. There's no going back and saying, well, now we're going to do it properly. Like, no, you've already made the exception. Now everyone's going to say, well, we did it cheaply in the past by cheating the rules. Why can't I do it now? Why can't I build the 101 house with cheap black labor or cheap foreign labor? And then the 102nd house we can start building with our own labor. Then the guy with the 102nd house is going to say, why should I be paying three times for my house? Let's build the 110th house using our own labor. Then we can start doing this vision. 110th house guy is going to say, that's not fair. And then they just ad infinitum.
And next thing you know, you live in a Walmart.
Next thing you know, you live in the just another generic South African town that you can't tell the difference between any other town.
Yeah, it's not the kind of thing that you can franchise.
No.
Yeah, there's no Starbucks in Urania.
No, and there's no quick fix. We're going to stick to this idea. We're going to put our chips on the table. There's no arrogance of this is the winning recipe. It's definitely going to work, but we're going to try this, because the definition of insanity, that cliche, is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. We're going to do something different, even if it fails. And a lot of people wrote them off. They wrote them off as crazy. And the same happened with the solidarity movement. I remember Flip Bass, the head of the solidarity movement, told me once as well, where he's like, when we started this journey, the people laughed at us. A lot of Afrikaners laughed at us and said, you're crazy. It's never going to work. When they said, we're going to build a private technical college. They're like, never going to happen. Like, we're going to start, we're going to build a massive network of private security structures, neighborhood watches. They're like, no, people are never going to do that. And that's why I keep saying as well, and this is the hard fact that people need to realize, people don't believe their ears. They believe their eyes. So they, you can tell them whatever you want. You can say, well, these guys did it, and this is how it works. This is in theory how we're going to do it. Like, no. People only believe what they see. And that applies to the Solidarity Movement. It applies to AfriForum. It applies to Urania. You're not what you – what's that thing that Carl Jung said? You're not what you say you're going to do. You are what you actually do. So
I mean, the biggest issue in the West with this is we built lots of things. Like, if you look at the Canadian parallelism projects from – there's a few communities who have done this, who have gone and built their – primarily in education. They built large infrastructures. The issue is exclusion, right? And fortunately, exclusion is getting a lot easier here because – in order to be part of our communities, you have to make, you have certain religious commitments that are totally unacceptable in the broad culture. So there's kind of a forced exclusion, which I think actually elegantly parallels how you got to the position. Because if you wanted to reintegrate as Afrikaners into the broad culture in South Africa, it would be very difficult for you. It's not just a decision to have your own communities because for fun and exercise, it would be very difficult to reintegrate into, well, I'm not even sure there is a broad culture in South Africa.
The South African culture doesn't really exist. No, it's a community of communities. So South Africa is made out of Zulus, Khoisas, Vendas, Tsongas, Afrikaners, English speakers, you name it, Sutus, Pedis.
Whereas nobody in really Canada, can't,
but again, it comes back to that central question. People always brush it off to my, and a lot of commentators in the Afrikaner sphere's big frustration. A lot of Europeans and Americans and Westerners in general just write off this question of who are we? And like, oh, of course we know we are, but that's a waste of time. We need to start thinking about big picture solutions. Like, no, who are you? Tell me, who are you? Like, no, we know. Don't worry. We all know who we are. And like, I don't think you do, because as you said there about building something that's exclusionary, to be able to exclude, you need to know, well, what falls within the parameters and what falls outside. You can't just say, we figured that out decades ago. We know what we are. We need to start thinking about other stuff. I'm like, no, I think you've forgotten who you are. I don't think you can answer that question. And the only difference between a people that has an answer to who are we and a people that doesn't have an answer is a matter of time. So the people that just write it off and saying, we don't have to talk about it, that's a waste of time. It's something that's already been figured out by my ancestors 1,000 years ago. We know what we are. That type of arrogance is going to lead you to ruin. You need to be answering that question constantly. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Black Horse, about the imperative of not just the adults in the conversation, but also the children need to be able to answer that question. The only way to answer that question as a child is through what you are exposed to, through your family and through the community around you. So it's not something where you go to school and then you're indoctrinated of this is what an Afrikaner is. You learn the answer to that question through everything around you. You learn it from what your parents tell you. You learn it from the school. You learn it from your church. You learn it. You assume it, and you find it within the stories that your mother tells you before you go to sleep. It's everywhere around you. It's written on your heart.
Well, and this comes back to a comment you made earlier on, and I've got to close with this because I've got to go. But you said something like, this is not existential for you in the West. This is your hobby. And I disagree with that almost diametrically, because it is true that I can probably live my own life without ever being directly threatened in the way that Afrikaans are threatened. But on a generational level, our community will be gone in a couple of generations if we don't transform the way we do things. Mm-hmm. And so it's existential, but in a very different... but without the kind of imminency that tends to drive people to action. And it's a very, very dangerous kind of trap. Because
what you're saying, Black Horse, is that people are a lot more threatened than they realize that they are. And they're a lot more threatened than they don't realize that they're as threatened as they are. Because if they did, they would understand who they are and then what they would have to do. But until they actually have that moment where they understand who they are, you won't be able to forge them into a parallel community.
You've got your foot in the quicksand. It is like you actually are in an existential situation, but it's not right now. It's going to take another 2-3 hours or whatever. And it's very difficult to, it's a very, very dangerous situation because you have to, we still can act now, but, if this goes on another generation, we won't be able to. So,
but just to add some further thoughts to that idea, I mean, it might sound very harsh, but that's the impression that me and many other Afrikaners get when we are outsiders looking into many Western countries, is that when it comes to existential things, you write Substack pieces and you make videos and you talk about politics with your friends, and that's kind of where it ends. But we're, in contrast, we're at that point, for example, like I said, where you don't have a choice. It's not like, I think it will be nice if I join a neighborhood watch. That might be help me with some personal development. Like, no, if I don't join the neighborhood watch, my community gets worse. My community can
somebody get dies.
Very worse. It gets very, very bad very quickly. So it's not saying that there aren't people within the West that take these things very seriously, but on a broad scale, as an outsider looking in, just get this impression that everyone's like, yeah, there's problems, but we'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. Maybe I'll do my part by doing more regular streams and writing a bit more. Like, okay, but that's bare minimum. What else are you doing? Are you involved in your church? Are you getting people organized? Are you talking about these ideas with people in your community around you? Or are you just talking about these ideas among your friends online? Like, it doesn't mean that you should write off content creation as useless or a waste of time, but you have to be doing more, even if it's a little. It's almost like I haven't developed this thought too much, but I think I've been thinking about it where, you know, the difference between dream time and real time, where you have a dream that feels like 20 hours and then you were just taking a nap for like 5 minutes. But that's kind of what online activism is like. 20 hours of online activism is worth like 5 minutes of real world change. That's the impression that I get, where people spend hours and hours and hours consuming very stimulating mental content and things online, but they don't do anything in real life. But if they don't even have to really change the world, they just have to get involved in some capacity, even if it's just being more involved in your church. That's already, like I said, worth a lot more than online activism.
Well, and my personal standard for this is always like, are you taking time every day to pass your community, your faith, etc., from your generation to your children and to your grandchildren? Absolutely. And if that's not going on in your home, what are you doing?
Yeah, you want to save your country from moral decay, but moral decay is happening within the walls of your own home.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you talk, because in my situation, I feel like I'm almost in between two worlds, where our situation is not quite what it is in South Africa, but yet as the Dutch expat community here in North America, we're very much separated out. So like my kids' friends are they're friends together because their grandparents were friends, kind of idea. Right. And we all go to the same churches. And so we work very, very hard to build our churches, build our, maybe more so even the schools than the churches.
Yeah.
Right. because that's sort of the breeding ground for friendship, because these kids spend 8 hours a day together, or 6 hours a day together, riding the buses back home from school. And then they go to youth group together, they go to church together, and they grow up where they have an involuntary community of, they know who they are and they know who the other is. You know, my kids were like shocked when they went out and got a job and then would come home. You wouldn't believe what the girl at the thing was doing. And then, you know, she has had sex with 20 guys. And like, my daughter was like, just the people actually, I said, sweetheart, you have no idea the gift that you've been given being born into and being raised in a small religious ethnic subgroup. And she, all of a sudden, then the lights went off for her on the value of what she's been given. And now she can hold it in her hand. Right. But so the, my always question is how to take what I have and almost in a sense, make it more militant perhaps, but just take it to that next step, because the world the is closing in on us very fast and something has to be done before it's gone.
This is exactly right. Like, we built communities, a few of them in this part of Canada, the state is coming. We can smell it. The issue is how to survive that process, right?
And how to wake people up from their sleep in that sense. Like, they're all in a hibernation mode, and they think that they're safe, but they're not. And that's part of the. But it's surprising, as I have these conversations, like you say, Ernst, to talk about it with your neighbor. As I, you know, tentatively have conversations like this with people, I'm often surprised at how open people are and how much you find, like, oh, I thought I was the only person who thought like this, you know. And there's sometimes that we don't talk with people because we think that I'm going to be, you know, excommunicated from my community for being too radical, when in fact everybody has been quietly being radicalized on their own. They just don't know it because they haven't told anybody else.
That's exactly why I use that metaphor of the dream time and the real world time. Because people, you're probably familiar with Jay Burden's piece, The Tyranny of Just. I mean, that's what people keep telling themselves. I'm just a man. I'm just a regular guy. I'm just a father. What can I do? I'm just a member of my church. And that's the thing. I mean, that's why I use the metaphor of dream time and real time. It's like, yes, it's not. Don't write off online activism and online content creation like we're doing now. It's not useless. It's not going to not have an impact, but it's going to have much less of an impact than if you were doing something in real life. So, for example, as you said now, talking to your neighbor, just ask your neighbor, have you thought about this? Or have you seen this that's worrying me? Do you share this concern? Have you seen this thing that also is giving me a lot of concern? Do you share that? Do you talk about shared values? Talk about a shared idea of identity? I mean, and it doesn't take a lot. If I always tell people, if you are dedicating 30 minutes a week or 20 minutes a week to doing something in real life, you are already doing more than 95% of people out there. If you dedicate 30 minutes this week of just saying, well, I'm going to talk to someone new within my church or within my street and just talk about something that I think is important, almost in the bigger picture topic, but not in a way that you talk to a friend, not in a way that you talk to some other intellectual or someone on a podcast, rather just simple questions. Does this thing worry you as well? Or do you think that this would be a sensible way to counter this thing? Or do you think that it would be valuable to try this, some type of project or something that brings your community together? Already that one conversation is already doing equivalent, if not more, than online content. And as I say, don't misunderstand me. I'm not writing off online content. I'm going back to that idea that I talked about earlier about a multiplicity of strategies. So you should be creating online content. There's amazing technology at our fingertips that we can use to wake up more people, but you should be in the real world doing something as well, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just literally planting a tree with your children, saying, I want to plant a tree here because I think this would beautify the community and it would also learn us an important lesson of investing in the future. Even something that small. I mean, I can use my own personal experience in that regard, where I've planted many trees with my father over the years, me and my father and my brother. And that taught me a lot more than any book that I can read, any philosophical work about investing in the future. Literally planting a tree where I might not even see it flower or see it grow to its full potential, but I'm planting it here because someone in the future will be able to. Maybe my children will be able to sit under this tree. And one day, so I'm luckily, like I said, I'm very lucky that my father is still alive and both my parents are still alive. But one day when my father is no longer here, we can drive down the street in the town where I grew up and I can show my children, me and my father planted that tree over there 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And that's already, it's something very small, but I think it's already something that makes a big difference, even just if it's within the world of your family, within the world of your children. It's already something, it had a big impact on me. And I think that principle can be applied in any familial context.
Oh, there's just so much that I've still got dozens of questions, but I think I'm getting close to the point where I've got to let you go, Ernst. I'm hoping that we can do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
But I think it's just having you on and talking about your, you know, real world experience, because so, like you say, so much of what we do over here is theory sell, largely because we haven't answered that question of who are we? And we don't feel the existential need to just start doing something. And many of us are just very, very comfortable in what we have. And we're just slowly waking up to it. And I think sometimes we get overwhelmed. We look out and think like, okay, the administrative state is like all powerful. You have a military with a million men and all these ships and boats and tanks and airplanes, and they could crush me in a heartbeat if they wanted to. You know, like, what can I do against the government and all of its regulations and its lawyers and so forth? And actually there's, you know, a surprising lot. Like you say, if you just start having a conversation with your neighbor, strengthen your church, build your community, you might be surprised at what your neighbors are thinking and what they're willing to do to build something that is far more self-sufficient. And then this idea that we build it ourselves, which I think is so, so important.
If you build it yourself, you can actually claim it. You can say,
yes.
Nobody else can say they built this. I built this, and I've got the papers and the evidence to prove it. It's the hard fact because their leftists have a strong point where if your people or your nation exploited cheap foreign labor in the past, you can't have a 100% claim on everything that's built in your country. That's just a fact. Can't get away from it. No amount of political rhetoric can have you escape that. If you didn't build it 100%, you don't have a 100% claim on that thing.
And that may actually be, you know, those two lessons in a sense of answering the question, who are we, you know, being able to ensure your claim on what you've built by doing it yourself. And then just be willing to talk to your neighbors, I think are the big things. And then just start. Because and that's how
don't succumb to that tyranny of just don't think, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm just a man. I'm just a normal person. Like, no, like I said, if you just with intention go talk to someone in your church or your street or your neighbor about something that you think is important to your community, you're already doing more than most people out there.
Even if it's like simple beautification, to sense like we pick up the trash and we are not going to live in a community that's dirty.
Yeah.
And to say, like, we as a few neighbors, let's gather together a few people and go around and pick up the trash in our neighborhood, because we just refuse to accept to live in a community where there's garbage blowing around.
Yeah. Immediately, you're instilling your children with a standard of your environment tells something about yourself. If you live in a dirty environment, that's going to tell a story about you. And you should be above that. You should be working towards living in a place that's nice to live in, that's clean to live in, that's safe. How are you going to do that? You're going to do that through begging the government to do, groveling before the government, come, please make my community safe, beautiful, and clean. Or are you going to start doing it yourself? It's a very difficult thing because it takes time and effort. And like I said earlier, you're fighting against human nature, but you're going to have to start doing it at some time, even if it's not your entire community. An organized minority always beats the living hell out of a disorganized majority every single time.
And this really is the heart of the political, in a sense of us, you know, if you want to talk about self-government, self-governance is taking ownership of your own communities at a local level, just being willing to go out and just do the things in a sense, like, don't rely on the school board to do it. Don't rely on the city government. Don't necessarily say, hey, we got to lobby the government to do this. Hmm. Just actually start getting together the neighbors and just start doing it.
Yeah. And if you do it, you can actually claim it and say, well,
it's ours.
You might, yeah, it's ours. And you might actually learn all this time you've been lulled into this state where you believed you couldn't do this until the point where you actually try and you realize, well, we could have been doing this all along. What else can we do? What else is out there? What other responsibilities are out there that we can claim? Claiming responsibility is an amazing thing. We're living in a time where you just want to outsource every single responsibility because then you can live comfortably. But look where that got us. We need to start reclaiming responsibilities. And the first, as soon as you reclaim successfully one responsibility, immediately the entire world opens up to you. And you start asking, but what other responsibilities have I been telling myself all this time I can't handle?
Yeah, stop outsourcing your own responsibility to the government. And right. And then whining and moaning about how the government is ruining your society, yeah, and just start taking responsibility for stuff.
That's what happened with Afrikaner schools. We outsourced the Afrikaner schools to the government, and then our government started turning our education institutions into English, and then that was it. What do you do then? Well, you pretty much created this environment by outsourcing that responsibility. But if you take that responsibility, you claim it, then it's yours. And you actually have influence over it.
And you have Afrikaner schools. And for most of us in the North American context, because we have a homogenous language, it would be more along the lines of your Christian faith. For many, I think a lot of these dividing lines are going to shake out along the lines of Christian faith. And so if you don't like what the government is teaching your kids, you're starting a school is a perfectly acceptable application. A perfectly acceptable option that you can take responsibility for their action. And yeah, you're going to have to make some sacrifices and it's going to affect your standard of living. I know this very personally from my own experience, it affects your standard of living, but I also am confident that when my kids go off to school every day, I know what they're learning.
They're not going to come home and hate you as a parent.
No. Or if they do come on and hate me as a parent, it's something I've done to limit their life and their privileges and so forth.
But they weren't taught in the classroom that their parents are evil and their grandparents even worse.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And that we're all monsters and bad people for doing X, Y, or Z.
Yeah. Anyways.
Anyways, Ernst, thank you ever so much. I'm going to end the recording. Again, maybe as people too, if people want to find out more about your work, where can they go?
Well, they can. I'm pseudo anonymous, so I'm not officially anonymous, but I do like the little bit of a layer of privacy that it gives me. I post under Conscious Caracle. You can find me on X and also on YouTube. On my YouTube channel, I interview interesting guests focus in on topics that are relevant to South Africa and the wider Western world. So no episode is only relevant to people that live in the West or people that live in South Africa. It's always to both. And on my X account, I just share some of my thoughts on politics and culture here at the southern tip of Africa.
Very good. Again, thank you.
Hmm.